Good evening. These days, it seems to me that many people are doing what we call soul searching. Soul searching. In other words, they are reflecting and asking very hard to answer questions about how to live this life that they have been given. And, you know, we engage in soul searching when we become confused, when confusion arises, when we're not sure how to proceed in our life or what direction to take. In other words, this soul searching is about when we are not certain what to do with life. In other words, when we no longer are certain that we know its meaning. I think everybody, I think each of us had a time early in our life when we were very confident we knew the meaning. Or at least we didn't think about it. And so we weren't troubled. But these days, so many people are trying to understand who or what they are. Trying to understand what they believe and what they believe in. And these are complex, difficult questions and self-explorations that I guess we all go through. But really what we are mostly asking about is, how do I live in an imperfect world? You know, the world that does not meet my expectations. The world that does not give me what I want. I think this is the basic problem that so many people face. How to live in this imperfect world. So this soul searching happens, I think, when we feel anxious that we have somehow reached a dead end and we feel we cannot go any further in the direction that we're on. And even though we don't know how or why we arrived at this dead end, we want to find a way to go beyond this barrier. Our modern world, our industrial world, or so-called enlightened world, began back in the 13th century, what's called the Renaissance. At that time, the human orientation started to shift away from religion, which had been so dominant for centuries before. People started to turn away from the holy, or the universal, and towards the individual. They felt the need to improve their intellectual life, their cultural life, and their material life. They wanted a better life. So the Renaissance arose as a response to a dead end in human expression of what had been going on for centuries. People wanted to find a new direction. They wanted to express themselves, their individuality, rather than submerge it. They wanted to learn and to explore what it was that interested them, instead of being governed by what the church told them what to believe. So there was a big shift several centuries ago. And over these past centuries, humanity has emphasized individualism, materialism, pursuit of ideas, and the pursuit of desire. And what we have learned and what we discover through our practice and what it is we talk about, that as more and more millions start to pursue their desires, then there is no room left for the universal or the holy. So we go too far in the other direction. So as long as life is based on our own personal ideas or our own self-oriented ideas, everyone's ideas will compete with each other. And you can see this competition all around us today in so many ways. So the dawning of the Renaissance was quite wonderful for us, for humanity. It provided people with the freedom to learn. It improved standards of living. It greatly improved everyone's health and life expectations. But just like all forms of progress, it came with a downside, or with several downsides, that can get out of hand. And that's where we are today. Back to soul searching and what direction do we want to go in? Our life becomes a difficulty when it is based on superficial ideas about ourselves. And particularly difficult when we recognize that we are becoming attached to something that we know is superficial and not what we really value. A few months ago by now, in one of the Saturdays when we had the film festival, we showed Lost in Translation. How many have seen Lost in Translation film? I've watched it about 4 times now. There is one moment that sort of speaks to what I would like to say, what I just trying to speak about. The Bill Murray character is sitting in the lounge of a hotel with the Scarlett Johansson character, and she says to him, "What are you doing here in Japan?" And he says two things. One is, "I'm taking a break from my wife." But he says, "I'm here getting paid $2 million to do a commercial for a liquor, for a whiskey, when instead I could be doing a play somewhere." And you can sense that he really is feeling really bad, that he's not doing the thing that won't pay him any money, but that he believes in. He's not doing that. He went for the commercialism and the money. And he's drinking the very whiskey that he's advertising. And to me, that's a very touching moment when somebody knows they've given in to their desire and they feel bad about it. And I think maybe some of that is happening these days. So our life becomes difficult and troubling when we pursue our desires too much. So the purpose of our practice is to not let our desires overwhelm us, but to let them find their way naturally into our life without disturbing or getting in the way of what we really feel we should be doing with our life. And the purpose of our practice is to allow our desires to be expressed appropriately in the midst of our life with each other. It's impossible to extend ourselves to each other if we become consumed with pursuing desire and our own individualism. It's hard to be close when we do that. It's a big misunderstanding. So our practice actually starts when we agree with this principle, with this idea, with this teaching. And our practice starts when we vow not to become a slave to desire. But even though we agree with this teaching, with this principle, and we do make a vow not to let ourselves become overwhelmed, it's not easy. It's not so simple. Easy for me to say. It's not easy. Because our mind has become very attached to ideas of itself. And the concept of the individual pursuit of happiness. And it's because we can't break this habit that we feel we've come to a dead end. The traditional Buddhist practice before coming into the modern world was that the monks and nuns left the everyday world to enter a monastery to break the habit of pursuing desires and promoting their individual selves. So they engaged in a kind of asceticism where there were no diversions, no indulgences, no convenience and small comforts. It is a way, a bit of a severe way, to cultivate an unselfish mind. In today's world, in the modern world, very, very few of us can spend years in a monastery, even if we wanted to. So instead, we have to establish places to practice like this. Places that we can return to and to rely on where we can learn to let go of selfish desires and to extend our true nature into our life and to discover selflessness. It is when we continuously try to extend our true nature rather than our limited selfish self, Buddhism appears. When we make that effort, Buddhism appears. And everything returns to its essence. And we feel confident and at ease. So if we practice with a humble attitude, then we will be able to understand the teachings and the practice. So we should keep confidence in our practice, not a confidence based on some kind of arrogance that comes from an idea that we personally understand something or have attained something or we are in control of something. That kind of confidence, which we call smug, that's only on the surface, that kind of confidence. It reflects a mind that has come to a dead end. A mind of stone that can go nowhere. So instead, our confidence needs to rest on something that goes on forever, independent of personal attainment. When we have that kind of confidence, we will have no trouble with selfish desires. There is a saying, from a Zen teacher in China in the 12th century. He said, "The green mountain is always moving, and the stone woman gives birth at night." This saying points to the very essence of things, the very heart of the matter. Its meaning is that there is no difference between animate and inanimate objects. There is no difference between sentient and insentient beings. There is no difference between man and woman or between people. There is no ultimate difference between anything. The stone woman gives birth. This is an expression of the selfless mind, which is awake, alive, and not at a dead end because of dualistic understanding that comes from an uncontrolled desire. So when we see everything giving birth continuously, we are giving birth to our true nature, and our soul searching is over. Does anyone have a question tonight? Yes, please.
This might sound simple, but exactly how does this practice prevent your mind from being attached to these selfish desires? I guess, what's the mechanism? How does it?
Are you an engineer?
Yeah.
It doesn't happen that way. There's no mechanism, and there's no such thing as exactly. You just simply practice. See what happens. Thank you. Yes, Umar.
That's two things. Listening to a lecture, and I wanted to share something. This person was saying this, and it was a really interesting thing. This comes along with what you just talked about. There's no separation between the animate and the inanimate. He said that wisdom is knowing that I am nothing. Love is knowing I am everything, and somewhere in between those two is where my life moves. And I was thinking, this is so, this is all so perfect. What you just had said and what I heard, what people call individuality is not really individuality, it's individuality. Individual is a person who's not divided. And coming to this practice, it just seems like this is what happens, is there's less of this feeling that you are not connected. It's more of a feeling that we are all connected to each other. And it's amazing sometimes to sit and feel that.
Thank you. Yes, Don.
So desire comes from ignorance? What's the source of desire? I suppose it's ignorance. And how is it that there's ignorance?
So the as the Buddha's teaching tells us, desire is the result of ignorance, and why is there ignorance?
How is it that? Yeah, why or how is it that?
Because the mind is always doing that. Thank you. Yes, please.
How can we better listen to that which does not wish to speak?
How can we better listen?
Better listen to that. Listen without demanding something be answered. To listen patiently.
How can we better listen patiently?
I think so. Especially to when what we're listening to doesn't want to speak. Isn't ready to yield anything to us.
How can we better listen? If we give our entire being, our attention and our entire being, to the other, we can hear all there is to hear, so that we and the other are no longer separate. When we eliminate that separation between our individual self and other, then we see and hear everything. Yes, please.
So I think you have you have given a lecture of very hard to understand topic of materialism versus getting over the desire. And the best way to practice is what I have understood from your lecture is to practice the teachings. Now, would you prefer say that there is any main teaching that will help me, getting over materialism and understanding? So how to, when I'm trying to get over materialism and getting over my desire, what main teaching should I focus on?
For that, you can't rely on somebody else's words. So there are many things you could read, but the most important thing is your own effort and your own practice of letting go, which is what we do in this practice. We try to encourage our mind to just simply let go of all these things. And that includes the teachings. Thank you. Jayshree?
Is duty and responsibility another type of desire?
Is responsibility another type of desire?
Yeah, is that just another desire? Is that a desire?
A desire has to do with something personal, something that will benefit us personally. This is desire, but if you have a feeling, there's a kind of desire that's not personal, like we desire to save the world, or to save animals, or to take care of nature. That's not a desire in the sense, in the karmic sense. That's not really a desire. That's, if we feel responsible for taking care of each other, this is not a desire that creates suffering. I don't know what to call it. Desire isn't quite right because it gets confused with the other kind. What would be a good word instead of desire? I'd like to think about that. The instinct or the urge to take care of something, to prevent suffering. This isn't a desire. This is very heartfelt. So when we feel responsible in that way, it's not the desire that creates problems. It's a desire that wants to prevent problems. Oh, excuse me.
So, I think there are two kinds of desires, right? Like you mentioned, one which benefits the community or the whole world, and then there are desires that benefit you, yourself personally. But even in that category of desires, you have desire, for instance, if you want to be more healthy, you want to take good care of yourself. That doesn't cause any destruction, or it's not a harmful desire. So not all personal desires are bad either. It's a very specific category of personal desires that might be harmful for other people or is selfish in nature.
What is the? I didn't understand the question.
So not all personal desires are bad. It's only personal desires that cause damage.
I think we're talking about desires that would take something from somebody else. These are the kinds of desires that get us into trouble. So, you know, maybe we could have a list of different categories of desires, the kind Jayashree is talking about. And so, but that's a good point. Taking care of our health is not in the category of karmic desire that harms other people. Of course, if we want to take care of our health, and we drive to the gym, okay, and there's somebody in our way, and we blow the horn at them and yell at them and scream at them, then the desire for health is compromised. Thank you. Yes, Rich.
You mentioned at the beginning of your talk the Renaissance period, and we've gone through many periods of human history. Does humanity improve through time, through evolution, or we have democracy, or maybe we just have capitalism now? And are we just going around in circles, or is there growth and improvement? I know we're not supposed to have a gaining idea personally for ourselves. Is there a gaining idea for all of us as like a global humanity, or is that something that we shouldn't even? Is it just beyond our control? And you know, I see progress, but I see, you know, setbacks as well. So, are we just going in circles?
I think maybe we are going in circles, but the circles are expanding as we gain more experience, as we get wiser, as we develop more of a feeling for each other and learn how to behave more compassionately towards each other. Our circles become wider. And, you know, when you run around a small circle, you have to go fast. When you go around a very large circle, you slow down. And I think maybe that's what's happening. We're still going around circles, but they're getting larger. Just in the last 100 years in this country, we have women's rights, which we didn't have 100 years ago. We have less discrimination against people who aren't white male. We have much more inclusion. And so I think that's an example of the circle getting bigger. But still we have the greed and the corruption that's always been with us. But I think incrementally we are getting wiser. Thank you. Oh, yes, Dave.
I've been thinking about Jayashree's question about responsibility and also this question about good desires versus bad desires. And I think one of the things that can be quite tricky sometimes is that aside from the kinds of clearly selfish desires that are just selfish to their core and hurt other people, one of the trickiest things to deal with can be when something doesn't start out that way, but then it gets corrupted. There was a time last several years ago when I was struggling with considerable anger over something that had happened to my family. And you pointed out to me that what was really happening was I was feeling deep compassion for my daughter, but I was allowing my ego to turn that into anger. And that if I would just stay with the compassion, the feeling wouldn't go away, but it wouldn't be corrupted that way. And I think that's one of the traps that we can fall into. I know some people who are very wealthy. They are very generous with a lot of their money. They were, in fact, recognized as philanthropists of the year a couple of years ago in Silicon Valley. But they're very, very ego-involved with this self-image of themselves as being generous philanthropists. And so, even though this starts out with a compassionate motive, it gets this sort of crust over it of egocentricity and desire. And I think that's something that we have to be very, very watchful of.
Thank you. Oh, yes, Hernan.
Just mentioned what desire and wiseness somehow made me think that those are two very different things. But it made me think that when I married later, I have three small kids, one is five, one is four, the smallest one. And talk about desires, I mean, they have one desire per minute. They have a lot of desires at the time. And if they don't get it, they cry. And if they get it, they're happy, and it can be a big mess. But at the same time, because they're kids, because the attitude they have, we end up laughing, and it's refreshing. Even their desire can be foolish, but at the end they're refreshing. And it's a break to have to deal with desires from a kid. So think about wiseness. Do you think that some kind of wiseness would be to try to remember what kids are and behave like kids, even with our desires and other desires, but to try to recover that freshness.
And how old are your kids?
10, 5, and 4.
Huh? Okay. Thank you. Yes, Columbine?
You mentioned that sometimes the world is not how we want it to be. It seems like that's a sort of common feeling for a lot of people. And I guess I'm just wondering, do you feel like people have always felt that way through a long time ago? And
yes, I do. Think that that's been a real problem for people over the centuries, and I think it's this dissatisfaction with the way the world is explains in great measure why there has for thousands of years been an emphasis on an other world, a better world, going somewhere where it's better. Because this is so bad. Because this is felt to be so bad. So I think that that kind of suffering has always been with us.
But why do you think there is such dissatisfaction?
Oh, well, until recent times, life has been very harsh, you know, for most people on the planet. Standards of living have started to become better over the last 100 years, couple of 100 years, so some of that is easing up, but still when you look around you see the hopelessness and the pain that still exists. Even in advanced societies like ours, there's still dissatisfaction. So I think it's still with us, and it takes a different kind of understanding to see the world in a different way. Thank you. Yes, please.
Yes, I have a follow-up question to my ladies here about satisfaction. My sense is that satisfaction is really a relative. It's a measure of what we think we want, what we desire, and what we have. And we look at over centuries of the difference between what people wanted, I mean, aside from the basic necessities. Because technically, if you have the basic necessities, you could be happy. But we're not. Now we have more, but we desire more. And if we don't, there's plenty of things around us to show us that we should desire more. Or we're being bombarded with advertisement tell us we should desire more. So, is that a explanation for why we have even more unsatisfaction, dissatisfaction today, perhaps? Because we just have more desires and more things.
Modern day materialism is very successful. Stores selling merchandise continue to sell merchandise. Advertising still continues to convince people to buy things. I think the desire for these material things comes about when we aren't satisfied with ourselves. We aren't satisfied with who we are. We aren't comfortable with who we are inherently, or we don't recognize who we are inherently. And so we define ourselves through materialism. There is an example of that I heard was the 10 hammers syndrome. A man had so much stuff in his tool shed. He had 9 hammers, but he couldn't see them because of all this other stuff. So he went out and bought a hammer. And he had 10 hammers. I think that's a fairly good description of what's happening. Thank you. Yes?
This is just a comment added to Carl Bein's question. And I think no matter how perfect we get as a society, I believe that dissatisfaction, the tendency to be dissatisfied, is built into our genome. And that's what has propelled us forward. It's like an evolutionary mechanism. That's my understanding of it, that some level of dissatisfaction is good. It pushes you forward to make things better. And that's sort of built into our DNA. We can learn to tame it for our benefit. That's...
Well, there's a dissatisfaction that comes from feeling, oh, we can do better. We don't have to stay satisfied with this. We can do better. And then there's a dissatisfaction that says, why am I being deprived? It's the other kind. Who's depriving me of what I want? So probably you're right that it's in our genes that we continually look at our world and say, oh, we can do better. This is a very healthy human trait, human quality. And probably, I'm not so sure animals have it, probably only humans. Thank you. Oh, yes, please.
Do you think in our Constitution it's written, they wrote that we have the right to pursue happiness? Do you think that that was, I really don't know what that original meaning was, but do you think that that is an unhealthy desire?
Based on their understanding at the time, probably okay to say that, but I think today we know a little bit more that pursuit of anything can lead to problems. And we really can't pursue happiness, that it's already right here. It's not out there in the future. And this is a new kind of wisdom for us. And back then, it wasn't recognized, I don't think. So what they said wasn't wrong, but now we see that there is some shortcoming to it. Thank you. Oh, Dave.
Just a brief follow-up to Colleen's question. As I understand it, in at least some of the earlier drafts of that language, what it actually said was life, liberty, and property. And so this was a minor improvement. I'm not sure what the significance of that is. The pursuit of happiness, a little bit more general, there's property.
Good, thank you. Well, in those days, property was a big deal because you could only vote if you owned property.
Yeah,
that was a big deal. So that's one of the ways we've gotten a little bit better.